this episode of Time to Lead, the Chief Energy Officer podcast, a space for reflection and dialogue around human leadership in a time that calls for nothing less. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome another Chief Energy Officer, my guest, Paul Sonnefeld. Welcome, Paul.
Welcome, Boris. Thank you for having me. I'm so looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, me too. And well, give me an opportunity to introduce you to our listeners just briefly without running through your CV. So, well, to me, Paul is, well, first and foremost, a wonderful human being, a wise, kind, humorous, and deeply present companion on my own journey. You are also the co-author of Emergent, The Power of Systemic Intelligence to Navigate the Complexity of M&A. You're a teacher, you're an executive coach, an explorer of humanity, and in many ways, may I say, an elder. And for many years, you've also walked beside me as a teacher, as a coach, as a friend. And again, your presence and profound insights have opened new ways of seeing, invited me and so many others, may I say, and just into greater depth and courage and kindness. So in our conversation today, we will explore the field and the art, may I say, and the practice, let me call it, of systemic looking and how it can help restore flow, bandwidth, and connection in ourselves, in top teams, and hence in high-performing organizations. So, Paul, welcome again. And maybe to open the space for our conversation today, may I offer the following question as an invitation? Paul, what did you say yes to by being here?
I love that question. The first thought that comes up is friendship. You know, we've been, like you said, we've been working together, and sometimes we still do. We also reflect together and find out what sometimes is in the way. And we've been working together for a long time. So friendship is definitely the first word. And the other one is curiosity, because our conversations are always surprising and are always filled with something that we have not thought about before. It's not a, even if we plan it, like we planned the time today, I have no clue where we're going. And you said something about the art of systemic looking and flow and restoring that, and maybe we're going there. I came with an intention to be about friendship and about honesty. So maybe it's going there. Maybe the honesty is wanting me to go somewhere else. And I love that we can, you know, talking about flow, that we can flow. Our conversations are always flow. And most of the time at the end, we are pretty okay with it. So I hope we'll be okay with this one. And not just for us, but also for the people who are listening to it. So, yeah, that's a little bit how I'm sitting here on this Friday.
What an invitation on this Friday. So, well, we use the word systemic, and it's, well, it's a heading. It's a word, right? So maybe for a moment, in your own words, what does systemic intelligence actually mean? So how would you describe it to listeners and leaders who've never heard of it or might be thinking, you know what, I really have other things to worry about?
Well, it is the simplest version to say it is that it is a methodology to work in and with complexity. It is It is a way where we distinguish everything that we can see in an organization, in a meeting, in a conversation like ours. Everything we can observe, everything that we can measure, in that methodology, we call that symptoms. Because we're not interested in the symptoms, because they are the outcome from a deeper pattern. So systemic intelligence is actually a way to start seeing or observing those patterns and then intervening with those patterns, or nudging them, as I call it, so that multiple symptoms start to disappear. Instead of putting out all these little fires, you turn down the source of it, you turn down the pattern that creates it. So in itself, it is a more holistic way of working. So you still use your brain and your analytical logic, but you use that both in the observation and what you see, but you also use that what we call systemic logic. So you also use your body, the sensing of your body, the input your body can give you, the wisdom of your body, I would say. So you use all your senses. And and I think that is what we do. And that is what it contains. And it is sometimes a very relaxing way of looking at situations in reflection and double reflection. So we take a little distance. Instead of going really into what's happening, we take some distance and we start to observe what are the patterns that we see, so that we can work together with those patterns, or we can help those patterns to shift a little bit with especially complex situations. And, you know, I don't have to say much about that we're living in complexity next to all the other forms of complicated difficulty issues. And it is just a deeper way of seeing.
Well, I'd love to hear, when you use the word complexity, what do you mean? So it's a word that's often used, and my sense is you have a different understanding of what you mean when you say the world and the problems we're looking at are in nature, in essence, complex and hence need a different way of looking. So say a bit more about that.
Complexity, the word complexity, and I refer back to the Canavan model of David Snowden, but complexity in itself means that everything is connected with everything. So if you change one thing, other things will start to change as well. It's almost like it's not a chain reaction, because that would be linear, but it is more like a mobile over a baby's bed. You know, when you touch one thing, that whole thing starts to move, and you never know how it's going to end, how it's going to stop, in what different position is it going to stop. In nature, everything is connected with everything. You know, if currently just around the corner in the park, we have a flower or a plant that came from China, and that is now prevalent here, and that is changing. If you see that as a pattern, that is changing everything that's happening in the park. All the other plants are responding to it. Some are dying because of it. Some are becoming bigger to kind of like hold it back. Others are starting to work together with it. And that is also with the issues that we walk into nowadays, is that many, because of the globalization as well, but also because we start to sense and feel much, much more the tensions in the world, and we feel that in our bodies, although sometimes we don't notice it, but also tensions in different countries, and many countries actually. And with systemic intelligence, for one thing, you look at where the connections are, but you're not starting a 10-step plan, because that would be working linearly. That is good for all of things. But when there are multiple people involved, then you would immediately expect it to be complex. No, have a conversation like we are having, but we are a little bit aligned on what we're talking about. But if you have a birthday party, a lot of people in the room, and you put a topic like politics in the room, which is really nice and dangerous, so many different meanings, and how do you still stay connected with each other? That is complexity. Complexity is also, you know, it needs something different from us. It needs more than just our brain, because it also needs our neurological capacity to hold ourselves and not have to step away and walk out, or to become angry, to release tension through anger, or collapse and say, I can't hold this anymore. I can't talk about this anymore. So complexity asks a lot more of us. And for me, then it also makes sense that because it asks so much of our bodies and our neurological systems and also of our understanding and even our humbleness, that we often don't understand everything. And all of that is in complexity. So saying that we're going to simplify complexity is actually denying that there is complexity, because when it's complex, it's not simple. And when you say you simplify it, you don't serve, you know, talking about leaders, you don't serve your people well if you actually, you tell them a fairy tale. I wouldn't call it a lie, but you tell them a fairy tale.
I'd love to explore that a little bit, and these fairy tales. So in a sense, and maybe you have a few examples from your journey working with individual leaders or teams. On the one hand, what happens when we look at complex situations with our tool set of complication? So we analyze things, and what happens then when we tell fairy tales, as you just called it? And on the other hand, what changes when leaders or any of us include our bodies, the whole, that complex field that you're pointing to? What becomes possible then? Maybe you can share an example of where this becomes evident and tangible.
Yeah. You know, let's go to the first part of the question first. When you use purely the analytical tools, and they have a very good place in consulting and figuring out complicated things, like getting a rocket to the moon is a very complicated thing. But you can do that just with science and brain work. If you use that in complexity, then what we see happening, and that is what leaders very often can recognize, is that either a problem becomes worse and it goes out of hand and it becomes harder to solve, or it disappears a little bit or for a short time and it comes back again. It becomes a repetitive problem, and I would say a problem that has never been solved so far, but it goes away for a while and we think we've managed it, and then later we see it coming back, and it could be in a couple of months, it could be a year from now, and it might come back in a little different flavor.
Disguise.
A little bit in disguise, you could say. But when you really look at what is really happening, well, for example, resistance in an organization that has so many colors and so many hats, you could say, it shows itself sometimes in sabotaging, just not doing the work completely as they would like it. It could be in resistance that people don't want to step into a change program. It could be that people become overly loyal and want to stay in that same team all the time, where the team might have served its purpose, and actually the best thing for the team would be to dissolve it and find different places for the people who are in that team, because what they are doing now has served its purpose and is, but we want to keep that status quo. All of those are different versions of that something hasn't been looked at, that something has been ignored. And then the system, or the in this case, maybe the team, does something that looks like resistance, but actually they're asking attention for something that maybe they themselves even can't really name, but they sense it, they feel it. Something needs to be honored first. And to give you an example, the book we wrote is about, amongst other things, about mergers and acquisitions. And recently I was talking to a leader in a company where they had just acquired another company. And one part of that company was just fighting against going into the new organization and to do it as the new organization was doing it. And the new organization was very successful in general. And the company that they bought were, you know, was, you know, middle of the road. Was okay, but it wasn't. But for the buying company, it was a nice addition to their portfolio. And we had this conversation, and he said, you know, they're really almost fighting against us. They're really, any proposal that we bring to them, they reject, and it's not good enough. And no, we can't do this. And we want to stick to our guns, and we want to do it the same as we did it before. And so in that conversation, I asked him, I said, did you ever ask them, what are they protecting? What is the function of their resistance? And then it was a little bit quiet for a moment. And then this leader, which is also an energetic move, but left a big sigh. And to me, and I've learned that from one of my teachers, is a sigh is a thank you of the body, or you could even say more esoteric, a sigh is a thank you of the soul. So when you get a sigh like that, something really entered that leader. Something really dropped in. And as if he, and he didn't have the words for it, as if he suddenly had an insight that gave him a completely different lens to the situation, completely different way of understanding or connecting to the situation. And I think that is what systemic intelligence does, is to see the things that are happening in a larger frame, in a more reflective, and we ask ourselves what's something that we often don't like. No, we don't like resistance. We like flow in an organization. We like to move forward. We like to, you know, achieve goals and grow and whatever we want to do, and have great relationships with our clients and with our the people in the organization. Actually, we want being at work almost to be a party, and it's possible. But as soon as we feel stagnation, as soon as it becomes harder, we don't like that anymore, and we want to break through. And I've seen that if you apply systemic intelligence, it is about integrating and not about breaking through. If you can integrate the resistance by looking at it differently, like finding out what is it serving, then you can integrate it.
Yeah.
And when you can integrate it, you will not walk into it anymore. Or when you walk into something similar, you recognize it much earlier.
I'd love us to stay where we are. So you brought in the notion of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And so often in conversation, I hear the sentence when there is, let's say, any kind of change, there is still resistance.
Yeah.
There's still too much resistance. It is seen upon as a problem. And then the question is, how can we get rid of the resistance in some way?
Yeah.
That's the question and hence the looking. So, and you said systemic thinking is a different lens. It's a different way of looking and actually leaning into it rather than trying to get away from it. So when you lean, so when you hear that, when you lean in, tell us about that lens. What are you looking for? What are you looking into? What are you paying attention to? For others to maybe visit, what could I pay? How could I look at it differently when there is resistance?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is when you label something as resistance. A beautiful question is to reflect on that notion and to ask yourself, why do I call that resistance? Is that because that is habitual? Is that because I don't like it? Is that because I don't know how to deal with it? What is resisting in me to engage with it, or to want to use force on it, or to want to get rid of it? That is the first part. Is there something in me that actually is resisting, so that I don't engage fully open with the people that we are talking to, that I already have set ideas and this is the set strategy and that's what we're going to do? But that doesn't mean that I really engage with the people, that I don't really connect with the people. Because if I'm resisting in myself what I see, then I most of the time I already have an immediate strategy what I'm going to use. And I might have a choice of three different strategies maybe, but I've got my decision is almost already made. But I do that in isolation. And organizations are complex systems where everything is connected, like we talked about earlier. So if I do it in isolation, I have no clue what the other side on the table, nor the other side in the team, how it is for them. I haven't asked many questions, except for when are you going to move? I might have had those questions, but those are not the questions that are going to be helpful. So we need to slow down a little bit, ask ourselves that question, and then to start understanding and create a willingness to want to understand what this resistance or this stagnation in a project not moving forward the way we want it, not fast enough. What is it telling us? What does it want to tell us? If that resistance could speak, is it protecting something that is valuable, that has been missed? Is it serving something? You know, the stagnation in a project not fulfilling, a project not coming to the end. Who is that in serving in the organization? It's an interesting question to ask yourself. What is the purpose of the resistance? And who is it serving? And you'll be surprised when you ask that question, honestly. Because there is an answer. There is a reason why there is resistance. And but also, what is it wanting to tell us? I've seen in mergers and acquisitions too often that with all good intentions, there is a plan to integrate the new company or to keep it half by the side or to not even integrate it, but just own it. And then we forget what that means for not only for the party who is being bought, but also for the party who is buying, the people who are connecting to the new people that come in from the other company. So if we don't create time for what that really will mean, because we're looking at, very often we're looking at, we have a spreadsheet, we have calculated what is going to be the advantage of buying this company and how we're going to get the results that we now integrate them, how we're going to get the results out of that as quickly as possible, because that's good for share price or market position or whatever. But we also have to deal with people in the organization. And how fast can they move? And what is valuable for them that we are neglecting? And when we neglect something that is valuable for people, they will start to resist. And so looking through the systemic lens means that you look at what's, and often we work with four basic questions. You know, what is the purpose of the company that we bought, and what is the purpose of our own company? And you'll be surprised how they differ when you really ask the people themselves. What did you need to do to belong in your organization, to be part of it, to be accepted as an employee there? What kind of behavior do you need to show? What kind of values are you attributing to? And if you talk about that with the different groups, you will hear very different behaviors, very different values. Well, values are something that people hold dear, that people live by. So if you neglect that difference, then obviously people are not going to be happy. And so people are going to resist, sabotage, do something to still honor their own values. And eventually that might become a clash. But what if you would honor those values and would appreciate that they have that and see how you can integrate that somehow? Or be honest about it and say, well, we see that those values were yours. These are our values. And we honor that you have those, but we're not going to engage one or two of those as a priority anymore, because it is different here. And you do that really in connection, and you listen to the stories, and you listen to maybe how difficult they find that. Maybe they need to grieve something. And that is a very new topic in organizations, grieving. And acknowledging that something will not continue. Like in a merger or an acquisition. That the old company will not continue. It will become a part of the new company. And it means you have to let something go. But also sometimes a company is being acquired because it will become the future of the acquiring company. And then the people who have been working in the buying company, they feel that they now have a lesser value because the new one is going to be the prince, the star. And now we, when we were the star, now we are becoming the cash cow. Oh, gee.
You know, the first thing you said, Paul, was systemic working has to do with slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
With pausing.
Yeah.
And from that space, then asking very different questions. And one thing I'm hearing in what you're saying is that, strangely, movement and change seems to start with acknowledging what is much more fully and seeing that, the pain, the grief, what was hidden, and just acknowledging it when some of our experience might say, well, that's all nice and good, but I need to move on. Let's look into the future. Let's get going. Let's not look behind. Let's not look back. Now, let's move forward. I hear that so often when you're saying, yeah, for that to happen, we need to pause so much more. So I think the question that is arising in me is, if I look at leadership as a daily practice, going from meeting to meeting, conversation to conversation, a few people are reading a book on systemic intelligence before they go into a meeting and say, how do I look at this? They might, it would be cool. But they might just, you know, there's a change management meeting, whatever.
Yeah.
What shape does pausing take? How can pausing look like in daily meetings? How can looking systemically look like in daily meetings?
Well, a very simple start is to acknowledge that there is more in the room than what we are talking about. And we know it, you know, we have the version of the elephant in the room. We have like then when somebody makes a remark and says, well, actually, you know, I feel very tense. And then somebody else says, well, actually, me too. Oh, yeah. And that person suddenly starts to speak something that we haven't really mentioned, but that is universal in the room. One thing that that helps, and this might sound a little bit silly, and I often do it with ex-cos, with management teams, to let them understand what is really happening. Because what the agenda says, we need to talk about this, that, and that. We need to make those decisions. We need to talk about that. So that is a linear moving forward, if we can, as fast as possible. That will not help you to see the things that are a little bit intangible, like the atmosphere in the room. Is it the right timing for it or not? Are we all really on board, or are we just bowing to the one with the largest voice or the most power or the highest rank? So one of the things that you could do it with a question, but when people stay seated in their chair, often the question is being answered not by a reflection mode of the brain, but from the still speedy answering mode. So I ask people sometimes, I ask them in a meeting to, after say 10 minutes or so, to stand up, stand behind their chair, and to talk about how are we currently meeting? What have we done for content, but how have we done it? So I bring in the how. Have we been just very effective and efficient? Have we heard all the voices, or have we neglected some? How have we done it? Was it just rushed and just pushed through by somebody? And it was not a discussion, but the person said, we're going to discuss this, but actually it was just, I'm going to tell you that you have to say yes to this. How have we done it? So there's additional information coming. So the content is what you could call cold data. And how are we connecting with each other? Did we include everybody? That is warm data. That is how, you know, I sometimes call it what's happening under the waterline. And so what you do when you slow down a little bit more in a meeting, you can get more information about what's happening and what maybe is holding you back. And maybe it's just a little sidestep first, checking with everybody. What is your opinion? What is your stance? How do you see this? And somebody might see it from a completely different angle. That is additional information that you need in the complexity. One way that we once designed a meeting specifically for a complex issue was that we had as many different people in the room as possible. So we had leaders from the higher ranks, we had employees from the middle ranks and from the lower ranks, but we also, because what we needed was many different multiple perspectives, because this was such a complex, such an in itself very tight issue, but and complex, that we needed many different angles to look at it to start to understand it at all. And so they had also invited a sculptor, an artist. They invited the musician. And we asked them not to become corporate, but just to use their skill, like a musician is very good in listening for harmonies and disharmonies, etc. And a sculptor is thinking in forms and movement and stillness. And it was wonderful how much information the group gathered together by just doing something different than let's go for a goal, let's go for the next step, let's go. So gathering all that information helped them to see the issue, the problem differently, with much more clarity, but also they could see the connections. So they knew if I pull on this thread, then over there on the other side, something is going to move. And I don't, that is going to be dangerous. So we need to do a different route through this. And afterwards, they walked out of the room and they felt two things. Let me start with the most easy one for them first. They felt very fulfilled. Although they hadn't solved it yet, but they felt fulfilled because they had more understanding of it and also more a felt sense of it. How to do it, but also what it did with them, how they could connect better to it. So that was the fulfilled part. The other part was that they had been, and they shared it honestly, they said, I've been struggling in this meeting. Because my normal way of doing is, okay, when are we going to make a decision now? When are we going to move forward? When are we going to make a decision? And when you slow down, and especially when you first gather that multiple perspectives, you don't want to make a decision immediately after. Because what you want to do, you want to let it stew a little bit longer. Because in the days after, more new insight is coming. And then at a certain moment, you have it crystal clear. I would say that systemic intelligence helps you to slow down, actually to go faster in the end. Because my true belief is that the amount of work load that everybody has now in the organization, but any problem you walk into in life as well, is partly that we are correcting the things that we didn't see in the beginning, and we have made a decision based on very limited data, and especially mainly only the logical data on the surface, and that once we start rolling out a program, we start walking in all kinds of things that we haven't anticipated, that we haven't build into our program, and that we need to correct and rethink and do differently instead of being a more slowing down and starting to already discover all the things we need to take into account much more, so that you can embed it in the whole process. And also it makes it easier to maneuver on the journey of change or transformation.
I'm so glad that we slowed down on the notion of slowing down.
Exactly.
and it much of what you're offering and sharing feels so counterintuitive in what is sometimes labeled as a fast-paced world.
Yes.
And the expectation upon leaders to get something done in a relatively short amount of time. What I'm hearing and what you're saying is a different way of understanding the purpose of my role as a leader in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
What am I here for? What am I truly in service of? As I am with that question, with this team, with this group. So if we pause on that a little bit, in terms of the purpose of leaders and purpose of leadership, the purpose of chief energy officers, if you like,
yeah.
What would need to shift for that to become real more often? So what might be a capacity that leaders will need to nurture, a belief they might need to nurture, and what might be, you spoke about grieving, what is something that might have to die because it is not in service so often anymore?
Yeah. Well, I think that one thing, that's what your book is all about, is how do they treat themselves? So if as a leader you can be fit, not only fit like going to the gym all the time, but also fit by understanding your own patterns that are running you, that sometimes are helpful and sometimes are not. So you have more choice and more awareness about yourself and your own beliefs, and are willing to sometimes challenge your own beliefs. I think that a lot more understanding of what patterns you're running yourself that have got you where you are, but might also not get you any further unless you change that. So see, I've been working with a lot of leaders and executives, and in one of the programs that we do, one of the key sentences, what got you here won't get you there. And these leaders are wanting to get to one of the top jobs in the organization. And it's pretty clear, you know, for example, a very simple example, if a CEO becomes a CFO, becomes CEO, there's a couple of things that you do or have to do as a CFO that you have to let go of when you become CEO, because you have a different mandate, a different task. So the task of a leader, and I think that's any leader, is to protect the team from outside pressure and from faster, faster, faster. Because you only need fast when you're in a real crisis, not in a perceived crisis. Because sometimes a perceived crisis is because you're using the wrong tools on the problem at hand, and then you feel like a crisis. So if leaders can protect their teams so that they have some almost bubbles in the speedy world where they can think a little bit more, where they can, you know, do that multiple angle viewing, when they have some time to really investigate the issue, so that then they can make better decisions and they have less correction work afterwards. That is one. And I think also to sometimes just change the way that we meet. You know, with one of my clients, I once called it, or they called it, a hangback meeting. They do a hangback meeting every 2 months. They get together, they talk for 10 minutes about what's current. And then they say, well, let's talk about this issue. And literally they all hang back in their chairs. And they just share what's coming up for them. And the CEO has become so fond of those meetings because they create breakthroughs in their thinking. They create breakthroughs in how they work with the company and how they can reshape it. They are they work in AI. It's a research institution for AI. But this is the management team. The management team is not in the content of AI. They are serving and helping all these PhD and master students who are in the content of it. And that world is moving very, very fast. And just by having those hangback meetings, as they call them, they have a silent moment. They have a space, a container to sit in and are not being disturbed. And they can just freely let come up their brilliance that sometimes in the speed is being suppressed. Leaders should start to create those pockets for their people. So it's not just that, I don't think that leaders need to move their people to become faster, faster, faster. I think that you're pushing down a lot of the capacity that the people have when you need to let them do the sprint all the time. You know, the athletics, the Olympic athletics, is a lot of different modalities, a lot of different disciplines. If everybody who is there, all the athletes, only have to do the 100-meter sprint all the time, you're not using the diversity that's available. So I think that reflection and creating reflection moments, real reflection moment, not like the 2-minute reflection moment, can solve many, many issues.
That resonates so deeply and also very practically. You know, I sometimes, when I'm in conversation with my clients, we say, so how much of your time do you spend in meetings of any sorts, like 2 people, 3 people? Well, for C-level colleagues, that's almost 100% or 90%, the majority of the time. For others, it's significantly above 50. So I think it's fair to say that if the way we're gathering, the way we're meeting, the way and what these meetings are on purpose of, if that isn't shifting, then nothing is shifting. Or in a positive way, that's where we have the most leeway. And what is happening in meetings? We expand our understanding. We prepare decisions or take decisions at the end of the day. And the sum of all those decisions takes us where we are. So it is where the work is happening. And what I'm taking away from what you were saying is, well, let's become very diligent and thoughtful about how we're using that precious time. I think it was Gandalf who said in The Lord of the Rings, all you have to do is... all you have to decide is what you do with the time that is given to you.
That's wonderful.
Right? And what you're proposing, well, here is a different way of thinking about the time that is given to you.
Well, it is, how do you, what is the quality of your using the time? What is the quality? Because some things need something different. And what we're doing is we have a certain way of meeting in general. Many companies have that. That's how we do it. And that's how every meeting needs to be run. And that's not true. Different topics need different meetings. So a good use of time can be to take a little bit more or to fill it not with data from your brain all the time, but from data from the larger system. And that's what we call intelligence from the system. Use the intelligence that is in the system. It is available. But it's like if you take the Eurostar from Amsterdam to Paris, it's a three hour and a half sometimes race to get to Paris. If you look out of the window and you keep the speed of the train, which is over a couple of hundred kilometers an hour, everything goes really fast, and what you see is it's green. There's some trees, and there's maybe a cloud in the sky. That's it. But if you really want to investigate what you're seeing and you walk through the terrain, it's not just green, it's also brown bare patches. There's little flowers coming up. There is, you see, and you, maybe you see a little squirrel or you see a little mouse going through the grass. But you don't see that when you go fast, fast, fast. But all that information is available in that area. All that information is available in the system. And it's not about we need to now put all that information in computers or in you know, in spreadsheets or whatever we put it all in. But it's just to become aware of it and see how can it help us to make better decisions? How can it help us? How can we understand that we need to do trials and tests when we work with a complex issue?
You've mentioned, so I love this notion of hangback meeting,
mm-hmm.
which
cool.
is in itself an intention, and it's such a lighthearted word, right? Mm-hmm. I love that. And if there were some listeners who said, okay, I hear you, Paul, and you said a number of times using our body and tap into that system, what might be a few simple ideas to start with? So how do I tap into that? What do I do? So what are a few things that you feel have been helpful for leaders to start practicing to listen to that wisdom of the body as much as they're listening to their heads, which is a wonderful tool as well.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you integrate the rest of it in my next board meeting?
Well, what some of my clients do, and I'm just going to share some of the practices that the clients do. So we have that hangback meeting. There's another client who, before they start their management team meeting, they take a moment of silence. Some take 1 minute, some take 2 minutes. And the silence is to create a break from the previous meeting to the current meeting, but also to arrive, because in our minds we can be very quick, but our bodies still are kind of like walking in the hallway while we are already sitting in the room. But also to create a break between the meeting I just had and the meeting I'm going to have. My role might be different, the topics might be different, the expectations of what I need to contribute here is different than what I contributed before. Take a deep breath before you start. That helps you to land. Most of the time I ask teams that I work with to take 3 deep breaths. And not just a deep inhale, but especially lengthening the exhale, because it helps you to sink in your body and you sink on your chair. So those are very simple things. And for some people, a little counterintuitive. Oh, do we need to do a hallelujah and meditate for hours? No, you don't need to meditate for hours, but for a couple of minutes would be nice. And just holding silence is also a form of letting your brain cool down a little bit. So that is it. Other things that they do is that they do these little breaks after 10 or 15 minutes and just ask themselves, how are we doing? What are we missing? Who haven't we heard of? So we invite the people that are a little bit less extroverted so that not the extroverts are only running the meeting. Because otherwise, why should the other people be there if only 2 people are running the meeting? No, it's kind of absurd. It's a waste of time for those people if they're not being included and really invited for their opinion, because most of the time they have a very good opinion. They just have not shared it. Like what we do is sometimes we say, okay, if we just take more small breaks so that people can attend to something else that is urgent, or they can attend to the restroom and not wait till their body is already asking them to go to the restroom, but the topic hasn't been finished, so we have to stay. And, you know, all that attention goes to your bladder, instead to the topic at hand or to your colleagues who are sitting in the room. Simple but good check-ins in the beginning. How are you doing? Not just to hear how they're doing, but also to figure out as a leader, is the team ready for the topic that I have on the agenda? Or aren't they ready yet? And do I need to do something different first? Having walking one-on-ones outside. You know, how fast are you walking one in your one-on-one, or are you really slowing down? Or with somebody who's overheated and you take them out and you walk with them and you gradually slow down your pace, and that gradually slows down their pace. So you calibrate with each other. Little things are the easy things to start with. And then when you start to see some of the results, then you become more open for a next step.
Thank you for sharing those. And I love the simplicity of it, in the sense that sometimes a small shift has then ripple effects on so many other things. It's this conscious, it's the intentional pausing, right? Whether the question that invites me is, how are you doing? Or what is present? Or as I sometimes call it, where are you in the mood lift? Or what's your state of heart right now? It's language that helps people. Or the physical setting, in the sense of how long is our meeting? I'm often asking people, how long are typical Hollywood movies? They're 90 minutes. They used to be 90 minutes until they made them 3 hours. But they, for a good reason, because that's the kind of attention span and physical span we have. And then we need a reset so that we can bring all of who we are to that meeting.
We used to have breaks in the cinemas. In the old
we
days,
used it,
we
indeed. Had those, yeah. Absolutely.
And it was partly for gaining a little bit more money, so it was smart. And it was also because the attention span, you know, and now you have the 3-4 hour movie sometimes. And we have a break again. Oh, nice.
No, but absolutely.
I think there's one additional thing that keeps nagging in my head that needs to be spoken, is that we briefly touched on grief and letting go and losing and missing. I think that we need to create space for that in organizations. I recently had a team where a team of nine, the leader was going to retire, and three others out of the team, or four others out of the team, so five out of nine in total, were going to do different jobs in the same organization. And then the leader said, you know, to the others, you know, don't you worry, I'm retiring, but you know, you're ready for the job. You can really do this, and da 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 da. And don't you worry, and it's all going to be okay. So I asked him, and it was a bold move. I said, "Are you cautious for your legacy? And are you also aware of your leadership shadow?" And he hadn't heard the word leadership shadow yet. You know, legacy is something you leave behind, but leadership shadow is something that goes forward. He said, no, but he became curious. So I said, well, what you are just saying is not true. And you're not preparing your team for the next phase, not just because you retire, but because 5 out of 9 are leaving this team. So the team, as we are sitting here, in a month's time, is dead. This team will die. And I use specifically those words to wake them up, all of them. I said, this is the last time, except for one meeting still to come, that you will meet together in this constellation. Never ever again afterwards. Because one is leaving the company, you are retiring, you're going to do something completely different. Yeah, they can call you, but you know how it works. And what happened, that two things, a realization that that was true, And the second thing was that they immediately realized, oh, we have something else to do. Because if those five people are leaving and four stay behind, how do we get the knowledge of those five and the experience still in our availability? How do we prepare for the new phase? Because the way it was being talked about was as if nothing is going to change. No, trust, nothing is going to change. You're well equipped. Well, more than half of the people were going to leave. And there were just four left behind. And there was a short shock. It's like, oops, yeah, we never realized this. And there was a release. Ah, this is true. And it wasn't that the leader didn't want to be true, but also the leader hadn't seen it yet. And then they started to, immediately in the moment, they started to redesign the whole way of being together, and the planning forward was a new one, a different one. What do we still need to learn from each other so that the four that continue this work can be successful? And what do we need to do to say goodbye to each other? So being honest about something is going to die. Something is just not going to continue. We think that everything keeps continuing forever. A good organization should maybe shed 20% of what they're doing, maybe 10, between 10 and 20% of what they're doing every year to stay current, to stay connected to what's happening in society. So that means that we need to grieve what we let go of. And we need to build in space when we do those change or those programs where we shift. We need to integrate it in that.
Thank you for bringing that back in. It is so relevant. And I feel that gratitude and grief are just so, they're just two poles of the same thing.
Mm.
It's like the grieving, I think, is a process of learning how to continue living without what was there before.
Yep.
And that takes time. And again, slowing down. And it is much more than, well, a leader has left and we gave him a good party and we shared our appreciation and then we're done. That's one ceremonial element.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much more to be done. What is happening inside of us? And I'm sensing a bit of grief right now because an hour has passed in no time. And I would like us to take a few breaths to just acknowledge this hour and what has emerged, what we're sending out there, letting go. And maybe as a ceremonial way of closing this or putting this into the hands and the ears of the listeners, Paul, if you could kind of whisper just one essential truth, one invitation into the ears and the souls of every leader, and it would just arrive, it would just be there. What would you love to send out there?
The sentence that comes up is that acknowledge yourself. Your body is wise. Listen to it.
That would be a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. for this
we
hour.
Could have recorded six podcasts and maybe we do more. Thank you, Paul, from the bottom of my heart, the bottom of my soul, for this little precious moment.
And thank you for the opportunity to create this container, this bubble together. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.